We're about to have a conversation with Dr. Nancy Eisenberg, whose latest book is White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. She's the T. Harry Williams Professor of History at Louisiana State University. And Nancy Eisenberg, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, I guess one way to begin, there was a litany of words, of course, everybody probably uses in almost every interview that they have with you. Waste people, off-scourings, lubbers, bog-trotters, rascals, rubbish, squatters, crackers, claders, tackies, mudsills, scallywags, briar-hoppers, hillbillies, low-downers, and let me add, rednecks. And that this world of poor white people and of class, as you write, has been with us, and people thought of them in the most derogatory ways since the beginnings of the colonialization of this country.
Yeah, that's one of the things I emphasize, is that we like to imagine that at the time of the American Revolution that we escaped the British class system. But in fact, we inherited British ways of thinking about the poor, particularly the emphasis on idleness. This is why we still today people dismiss the poor as lazy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The other thing that the British, the class that the British despised were vagrants. So another theme that is attached to the poor, because they're landless, they're seen as a mobile population. And that's very dangerous because that implies that they don't have a stake in society. They don't own a home. They don't own land. And this is another way in which the poor were thought of negatively and which Americans adopted and adapted from a British ideology.
So one of the things you do here in this book, which I find really fascinating, we spend a lot of time on this program talking about race and racism. We also have spent a lot of time over the years talking about class issues in America. But you analyze and look at certain things that we take for granted in certain ways. When you have that piece you wrote about what happened in Little Rock, Arkansas, or how you describe some of the reasoning that had to do with poor working white people about why we entered the Civil War. So could you talk about those areas? Because there's a nuance to it for people to hear that makes us think about how the role of race and class play. But those two pieces pop out as ways that you approach that history in a different way.
Yeah, I think one of the problems we have, and this is not just a problem that journalists have sometimes, academics do it, is this problem of thinking that race and class are separate categories. And if you look at this problem historically, one of the key themes that I talk about even before the Civil War is the way in which race and class get intertwined. And one of the key ways is another way we inherited a British way of thinking is through the language of breeding, the idea of pedigree, the
right.
idea of lineage. So this is really important, and it has both class meaning and it has racial meaning. And I highlight how that becomes a really important vocabulary to talk about manifest destiny. Now, when we get to the Civil War, that theme doesn't disappear. In fact, one of the leading Confederate ideologues who would develop the critique of white trash, this was a man by the name of Daniel Hundley. He would write a book in 1860, and he would argue that the class system in the South had nothing to do with the fact that they were poor or landless, or that slavery had somehow placed them at a disadvantage. He went on to argue, no, class was congenital. It was something that was inherited. And he developed a class system, and this is the other point that I make, to show that Americans had very sophisticated ways of talking about class, but he developed seven different classes
right.
for whites in the South. And at the bottom, he put mean whites, and then he also had poor white trash at the very bottom. And I think this is one of the things that we need to understand, is that the idea of white trash, this was not something that was invented by Northerners to talk about Southerners. It was a vocabulary that became very pervasive, particularly in the antebellum South leading up to the Confederacy. And when we get to the Confederacy itself, many scholars have noted that when the Confederacy was organized, there was a concerted effort for the planter elite to try to figure out, well, how do we get poor white non-slaveholders to vote for the Confederacy? And this became a crucial issue. And one of the things that they pointed out, even before the war began, they argued that their social class system was superior to the northern system. And if we look at the arguments of James Hammond, who came from South Carolina, leading Confederate ideologue, he focused on the mud still. And this idea shows you a perfect example of how their thinking involved race and class. Because he argued the South was superior because slaves were on the bottom. And he used the metaphor of mud still, which are the posts you put into the mud to hold up a house. So the same way Lincoln talked about the house divided, house metaphors were used by the Confederacy. He then went on to argue, and this is the idea that I think should be very surprising, that the South was superior because it had less social mobility. And when he looked north, he saw a very dangerous society. He saw a society that gave poor whites the right to vote. He saw a society that made them anxious, and there was too much mobility, and they dismissed, particularly people from New England, they dismissed them as being fanatics and uncivilized, and even went on to say that Northerners weren't fit to even, you know, shine the boots of a Southern gentleman. So when they talked about what they were preserving and what they were trying to save by secession, they used a class language, and that's what we forget. And they found a way, as I tried to show in discussing Hammond's ideas with this mudfill theory, as a way to both critique the North, which they saw as filled with, you know, socially mobile mudfills, and then the way in which their Southern society, with African-descended slaves at the bottom, as a more secure society.
So, and one of the things here that kind of runs through this is the intensity of feelings about poor white people in America, and the notion of poverty, and how things began to turn a little in terms of exploitation of that of the poorest white people when Andrew Jackson ran for president. He kind of turned everything on its head. So, you know, we've done a lot of analysis on the show about Andrew Jackson, the racist, and committing genocidal acts against Native people. But there's another part of the Jackson story that's really important here.
Jackson is a very complicated figure because you have to realize that he was not a great orator. He was not a great statesman. He's the first candidate to have a campaign biography. So many of the people who backed him up were the people who were defining who Jackson was. And when Jackson ran for office, we see two things happen. One is that when we think of the frontier, the old Northwest, or we think of the Southern backcountry, Jackson is the first Westerner because he comes from Tennessee. So he is seen as someone who represents the population in the frontier, and the terms that were used for that group were squatters and crackers. So he's identified because he doesn't come from the same kind of educated background as his rivals who ran for the presidency in 1824, John Quincy Adams, who had been a professor of rhetoric at Harvard. Jackson was not a highly educated man. So he's seen as embodying, even his nickname, Old Hickory, associates him with the land of Tennessee. So when we see Jackson, part of what happens is that some of his mannerisms, particularly one of the things that circulates about him, is that he liked to curse. It was called slamming oaths. And that was something that was associated both with people, soldiers, lowly soldiers, as well as crackers, who, you know, were not trained in the rules of etiquette, so they cursed. So we see this effort to make Jackson more like an average person. For example, when he was attacked, a letter circulated that he wrote that was filled with grammatical errors and misspelling. His defenders would come back and say, look, he's self-taught. So you find these elements where he's seen as being more of a common man. But as we well know, by the time he's running for president, he's not. He's extremely wealthy. He's a slave owner. And we also, you're exactly right, that you have this long history for the way in which he was more than willing to support the idea of removing Native Americans in order to advance the interests of whites into the backcountry, into the frontier. And that's where, I mean, that's one of the points that I made so interesting is the same way he thought about whether squatters, poor whites, should have a claim to the land. he used the same thinking in order to evaluate how Native people should be granted a right to the land. He didn't want to, he wanted to completely reject the idea that they should have rights of sovereignty or be treated as sovereign nations. And he instead argued that the rules that applied to them were the same that applied to squatters. If they owned land, they had to turn it into farms, and they had to make it productive. And if they didn't meet those standards, then that was used as a rationale to displace them and remove them from the land.
So in the time we have, there are a couple of things I really want to get to here from your book. Well, one is, you know, you mentioned earlier the whole question of pedigree and lineage, that people like Jefferson on down and Teddy Roosevelt were all, as you write about, just this was their part of their existence. I mean, it's what they believed in. But the flip side of that is the other part, which is eugenics, right? And you write a lot about this particular part of our world. When we think of eugenics, again, we think the eugenics is something that only happened when it came to people of color, but it wasn't just people of color. It was poor people in general that they wanted to stop from having babies and control the population.
There's a direct link, because for Jefferson and for people in the 18th century, Jefferson in particular, they assumed that the way you thought about advancing the nation was strength came through numbers. So one of the things I highlight is, from the very beginning, breeding, the idea of people reproducing, you know, advancing the size of the population. From an English point of view, that increased the strength of a nation. He also would draw analogies, as did others like John Adams, between comparing animal stocks and human stocks. So the language of animal husbandry, which is something, if you grow up on a farm, you're very familiar with, but if you don't come from a rural background, that analogy doesn't readily roll off your tongue. But it was very common. It would continue to be common throughout the 19th century. And the eugenics movement is just a fulfillment of this obsession that gets used over and over again to reinforce racial and class differences by resorting to arguments of pedigree, to arguments of inheritance. And what by the eugenics movement, you begin to see, they're not using the language of genes. They use the language of germ protoplasm. But it lays the foundation for how we think about a genetic inheritance. But you're right. One of the themes that is most disturbing is that in the famous Buck v. Bell case, Carrie Buck was selected because she was seen as the perfect specimen of white trash. And the person who selected her for sterilization was a Virginian, Albert Priddy. And he basically described poor whites as, you know, the anti-social whites. And the targeted group, and this is what's surprising, one of the major targeted groups for prominent eugenicists were poor white women. And the leading eugenicist, Charles Davenport, he advocated, before sterilization was the principal argument, he advocated that poor white women should be kept in asylums during their fertile years. And what's most disturbing is that when we look at sterilization, where does that come from? Well, it's the same way we think about neutering a dog. These eugenicists assume that you neuter the women and then you can control the next generation and make sure that it's not contaminated. And this also fed into racial ideas, because in the early 20s, you also get the famous Racial Integrity Act passed in Virginia. And one of their fears was that because poor whites and free blacks often lived in poor neighborhoods, they lived close to each other, there was a fear that poor whites would have sexual relationships with blacks, and that would lead to polluting the Anglo-Saxon race of the middle class and the upper class. And one of the things we have to understand about the eugenics movement, it was not advocated by a small minority in the population. Leading academics, such as Harvard, supported it. Politicians like Theodore Roosevelt, medical doctors, Alexander Graham Bell, believe it or not, was a leading proponent of eugenics. So we can't sort of say, oh, this was just a minority movement, a mistake, a sad chapter in our history. But it was so widespread. There were popular lecturers who made careers promoting eugenics. And even what became really popular were these Fiddler Family Fest, Fiddler Family Contest at fairs where people would have their children. First, it was babies being judged, then they had their whole families. And the family that was considered eugenically superior would win a medal just like a prize bowl.
I know. I think that. There's so many illuminating things about the book, but the eugenicist part just was – it's a really important piece for people to understand the complexity of that in our history because we tend to make things very simplistic. And I was thinking about how also, you know, the way you describe the beginnings of this country, of this – the colonization of the Western Hemisphere of what's now the United States of America as being a dumping ground for the what people call the dregs, the worst of their societies. The British,
yeah, this is one.
Right.
This is what we forget, and that theory continues. One of the key proponents of colonization, British colonization, English colonization, was a man by the name of Richard Hakluyt. He writes a very famous pamphlet to try to convince Elizabeth I to support colonization. And basically, what he has two things in mind. One is that the poor were taxing the British economy. You had to move them somewhere. So what did he imagine would – this is one of the functions of colonies, just in the same way that Australia was used to get rid of convict laborers. Convicts were dumped into the North American colonies all the way up until, you know, right before the American Revolution. It was also a place for rounding up debtors and dumping them into the colonies. And most of the disturbance, and again, a very disturbing thing about early colonization, a large pool of exploited laborers who became what was known as indentured servants, where they would serve anywhere from 7 to 9 years. Most of them were children. And this is the other thing we forget about our past, is that children were considered a form of labor to be exploited. And we had child labor. It was legally allowed to have child labor in this country all the way up until 1990. So that's another thing that's really important to understand, is exploiting child labor. And as I argue in the book, the way in which indentured servants relied on exploiting child labor also influenced the way in which Southerners began to recruit Africans and to establish slavery. Because you were a slave in Virginia, according to the law 1662, if your mother was a slave. So again, the slave status was something that was inherited. Again, that idea of pedigree, very important, defines one's, not only one's racial identity, but one's identity as a slave.
So, you know, you when you look at the latter parts of your book and you talk about the cult of the country boy, and the it's this double-edged sword, I think, is really important to explore. John Waters said on my program once when we were talking about some of the movies he's made, and I think the word white trash came up. And he said one of the only groups left in America that you can call that are poor white people, that you can kind of attack this way. So it was an interesting comment. And then exploring that later in your book, I was thinking about how you can that on the one hand, there's this exploitation of poor white people to get their vote and their support, and you go through a whole listing of people that have done that through American political history. And you bring to Sarah Palin and what happened to her with McCain and Alaska and how that's emblematic of that as well. And now we see Donald Trump. So I want, you know, that I think this it's really – it's a very complex and powerful story. And we kind of diminish it into just dumb racist rednecks.
Yeah, no, it's really disturbing. I mean, I was interviewed – for a show for On the Media.
Oh, yeah, right.
And
yeah.
It was Kevin Williamson of the National Review, who is originally from Texas, who went into this, you know, rant in sort of portraying all the people supporting Donald Trump as, in a sense, you know, comparing them, like their complaints were the equivalent of, you know, the whelp of a dog. And that's sort of one of the other themes that I highlight, is this idea that people dismiss poor whites as not even, they shouldn't even be allowed to have a political voice. Now, it doesn't mean you can't critique Donald Trump. It doesn't mean that you can't point out, as I also point out, and you mentioned, that politicians have exploited the fears of poor whites, particularly by relying on a competition, a zero-sum game that's often pitting poor blacks or African Americans against poor whites. But it's also equally disturbing that you can, you know, use, you know, revive these terms, and we've seen it with Donald Trump, where he's been called the white trash candidate, the revenge of the lower classes, as if these individuals, in a sense, they are either dismissed because as if they're the most racist people in the country, which historically is not always true either, or it diminishes the racism that exists among elites, or we get this idea that somehow that they are purely the pawns of, you know, leading politicians. And that gets really complicated when we try to sort of say, are they all the pawns? I mean, we know politicians always are selling something and rarely are making promises that are not going to be kept. And this is one of the critiques I raise, is the problem of democracy. Do we really have a democracy? Because I quote this Australian observer from 1949, mm-hmm. who basically was saying, Americans accept huge disparities of wealth. But what we accept, what we want instead, is what he called a democracy of manners. And what he was alluding to is he was saying that when campaigns are run, and this is particularly true of our presidential campaigns, we want our presidents to, or our candidates to pretend to be ordinary people. And we see this all the time. We see this as in Iowa, where the candidates have to wear plaid shirts and eat corn dogs.
Right, right, right.
Or the idea, you know, with Donald Trump that he puts on his bubble cap. And this idea of pretending, of entertainment, that we turn democracy into a spectacle. Because we see this all the time. I mean, you see journalists reinforcing it, like saying, we should evaluate our candidates on likability. Really? Should we? You know, we should actually evaluate them based on whether they're competent, whether they can do the job, just like we judge doctors and airline pilots. That's the measure we should use when we're evaluating political candidates. But we don't. And that tradition of trying to make them ordinary people really does go back to Andrew Jackson. And then it gets reinvented at different moments. But what you always tend to find is that the candidates are running, just like Donald Trump. They don't come from ordinary people. They come from the elite, and they just pretend to be ordinary.
And, but before we conclude here, one of the things I think I've thought a lot about in terms of the things that you write is that you can, whether again it's Andrew Jackson or whether you look at when you talked again going back to the Little Rock and how Orville Faubus and the split between the schools, an upper class white school and a working class white school, and they only integrated the working class white school, not the rich white school, that led to all this, led to the Battle of Little Rock, all of that. But race and class are very complex things. And so I wonder, and I'm saying this also as somebody who in their younger years in Chicago and in Appalachia and here in Baltimore, organizing among poor working people when I was younger and trying to bridge that racial gap by creating things. So talk a bit about your thoughts about what you've come to in all this research in terms of that class-race divide here that has happened between working-class poor white people and African-Americans and where you see that root and where you see it might be going.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's – you know, I'm a historian, so it's very hard for me to predict, but I do think – there's several things. There's no doubt, as we've covered, that politicians can manipulate the racial tension between poor whites and African Americans. And that's what Orville Faubus did. He basically decided that he was going to use the threat of a race war as a way to stop desegregation. And at the same time, what's disturbing is that before that Little Rock controversy, he had been seen as a much more liberal politician. But when he was someone who was ambitious, he wanted to be governor, and he decided this was his ticket. He was going to stand up to Eisenhower. He was going to stand up to the Supreme Court. And in fact, it worked. It broadened his popular support by doing so. So that's one of the things that we have to pay attention, that this strategy has been used over and over again by politicians to advance their party, to advance their career. I think the other tension, the one thing that I do want to emphasize, is that we can't just always immediately target poor whites and say that they're the most racist people in this country. This is another problem that we have, because a vast number of poor whites and blacks live side by side. They have relationships. They are not always at odds with each other. Now, they can be pushed into that tradition or feel threatened because of economic competition. But we have to be really careful that we don't sort of use poor whites as, you know, the only people who are, you know, racist or somehow the most racist. So that's one thing that I think we have to be careful of. And we also just can't dismiss all poor whites or working people and say that they don't have interests, or that somehow they don't understand their interests, or, you know, why is it they support Trump as opposed to Bernie Sanders? We have to realize that class plays out in a variety of different ways, and not just dismiss people because they don't think in a certain way. And I would, as I said earlier, I would say that even people who are from the middle class or the upper class, they don't always necessarily pick the right candidate either, or they aren't always responding to the most, you know, a sophisticated analysis of what's in their self-interest. So I think it's that problem of just, you know, dismissing an entire group and not understanding the class dimension. And the other point that I make is we should not equate white privilege with class privilege. And I think that's really dangerous to do when we assume that all white people have an automatic privilege over all people of color. It's not historically true. And I think that's also a dangerous way to deny how class divides us. And we need to embrace the fact that, you know, poor African Americans living in poor communities have a very different existence from upper middle class African Americans in the United States as well. So we have to recognize that to understand these divisions, we have to look at race and class together, not as two distinct categories.
Well, Dr. Nancy Eisenberg, I do deeply appreciate the time you took today. The book White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. An incredibly important history. We look forward to having you back for longer conversations with other people about these complex issues. Thank you so much for writing this book.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show.
We have to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll be talking with Scott Shane about his book, Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of Drones, about the killing of Anwar al-Awlaki and President Obama's use of drones. And on our way to break, I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. And money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com. Or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner.